We want to thank our panel members for speaking. I have a number of questions that I'm going to pose to our panel. But before I do that, I'd be happy to answer or have our panel answer questions that if anybody in the audience has that they would like to address first.
Yes. I represent supervisor education in the state. I'm puzzled when you're talking about the juvenile court. Almost all of the referrals from the court come from district courts, not juvenile courts, not the juvenile
court. Usually when we order supervised visits, we usually order DCFS to supervise them, or we will order them to go to a neutral supervisor that the parties can agree upon. I don't know if that answers your question.
And yes, from the Supreme Court. We just rarely see them.
We order it.
Okay. Now, any other questions from the audience? Okay, we'll see if we can get the discussion going. Lynn, do you want to ask a question before I go on my list?
Let me make a comment and ask for all three of you to respond. Remember the TV or the movies, Back to the Future? I feel that we're seeing, to some extent, the Back to the Future movement. Common law courts had jurisdiction over everything. The judges heard all kinds of cases. And that was the history of American courts until you began to specialize in the late 19th century and the early 20th century with the juvenile court movement leading the way, but there were other elements of specialization. The problem with specialization is, as you get more specialized judges with more narrow specialized jurisdiction, there is more fragmentation, or at least less coherence, that lawyers have to take one part of a holistic family problem to this court, and another part to this court, and another part to that court. So I would ask them to respond to the Back to the Future. Is the Unified Family Court movement just a throwback to the future, or is it moving forward to the future? And second, is the issue really coherence versus specialization? I have to add that I agree that Utah courts across the board, our Supreme Court, our appellate courts, our trial courts, our juvenile courts, are among the best in the nation. We are truly blessed with the quality of judges and with the organization. What we've been able to do with the resources we have is truly remarkable. We really are blessed. The question is, as we anticipate further changes, as we see with the explosion of family law problems, that must follow what you see. 41% of all children now born out of wedlock as of 2009 in this country. You cannot help but have family fragmentation issues and a whole host of problems. So is the question specialization versus coherence? Is this a step being back or is it a step forward? And just ask all of them to respond.
And before I do that, I could continue thinking about that. That actually goes to one of the questions I want on a more concrete level. Given the big picture on a concrete level, my question would be, if you're going to hear abuse and neglect, you're going to hear in the juvenile court delinquency issues, why not hear divorce too? Custody is part of the divorce, which may or may not end up being juvenile court under our system, and the answer is, you know, fragmentation. But why couldn't the judge handle all that? Since right now our district court judges handle everything else, all criminal matters and all civil matters and all domestic matters. So is that really the issue of fragmentation, specialization, or is it communication, or how would you see resolving that issue?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to say that I agree with my co-panelists and you that the juvenile justice system, the juvenile court system is truly impressive. I have not heard, and I've been working here for a long time, I've not heard of a system that has this degree of efficiency and compassion and coordination all rolled into one. So I'm really delighted to have learned about that. In terms of the question whether we're talking about fragmentation or specialization and going back to the future. I think in certain ways we are going back to the future, but with very new problems and very new trends. I don't really, I don't like looking at it in terms of specialization. I hear you. There are a lot of judges who say we're evolving into a system in many states of boutique courts. And the judges, as you say, are in a position of where they are obliged to learn about a very, very narrow set of problems. I think the UFC model is one model that militates against that, that judges are asked in a unified family court, as they are in the juvenile courts here in Utah, to really become informed about the whole range of activity of issues and problems that families in crisis have to contend with. Answers the question. I've lost track of some of the other questions.
Okay, I think we just want to hear your feelings on those issues.
Well, here's the way I think I'd answer the question, Lori. Utah Juvenile Court gets about 44,000 referrals every year. The vast majority of those are delinquency referrals. As a matter of fact, the way this works out is that 8% of the referrals in juvenile court are for child welfare matters, abuse and neglect, but they take 50% of the judge's time. So the question becomes, when, if you were to combine divorce into that process, would abuse and neglect issues take a more back seat to the divorce issues? And when you do some reading about family courts, there have been, I've read some stuff where it says when people have lived in family courts, the most important thing then became for their state or their jurisdiction, divorce, as opposed to abuse and neglect. And I will just tell you that that is exactly the reason why juvenile court judges are juvenile court judges, is they want to deal with family and kid issues. And any watering down of that, I think that they see it as a step backwards, if you will.
I guess I don't understand what is meant by watering down. I think that in a family court, all of the issues affecting a family are treated equally. Divorce, custody, abuse, neglect, alimony, and even more important, many of the same factors that go into, for example, deciding a custody case or is in a delinquency case can be seen in alimony proceedings or other proceedings, that these issues are so intertwined in family court cases that a very efficient model of dealing with them is to incorporate all of these cases under one roof, so to speak.
Gloria, in your experience with the family courts and different systems that you've worked with, has that turned out to be true, that the burden of dealing with the divorce has eliminated the focus on the abuse and neglect?
No, this is the first time that I've heard of it. I think, it could be in some cases that divorce is the catalyst for uncovering all of these other cases. So that's the first issue before the court, that starts out being the main issue before the court. But as I'm sure everyone in this room knows, very quickly in a divorce proceeding there you could get allegations of abuse, allegations of neglect, you can get substance abuse issues, all those other issues that affect that case as it moves forward through the justice system. So divorce may be the initial catalyst, but it's not one that receives the most attention.
Right. I think one question I might have, because I see a fairly large number of cases where divorce isn't even an issue. Mm-hmm. The parents come before me because, and I use the mess house example, so that case comes before me in a family court. I'm not sure how that works. What if the case comes before me and my assignment is child welfare cases, and then 5 years down the road, mom and dad decide to split up? Then does that go before a different judge? Does that come back before me? Or what if I see my first case is the Johnny issue, who has the 16-year-old with the burglary charge, and I'm dealing with him for 3 years. He's in the custody of JJS. And then the parents decide to get a divorce. Now, who does that go in front of, me, or does it go before someone else? a judge who is very experienced in handling property disputes and alimony disputes often has done that in his or her private practice. I haven't. That judge is not necessarily very familiar with JJS, with state supervision probation, with DCFS, and knows how to handle all of those issues. And you're putting a lot on that judge's plate, and I'm not sure that the economy would work out when we talk about, well, the judge has to travel to different courtrooms. Well, if I have a divorce and a property dispute, and I have to do alimony and child support, and I have to do child burglary, and I have to do the child abuse and neglect, I can't possibly do all that in one day hearing. That's just too much. So the family will still have to return to see me. And then what do I do with my other child welfare cases?
Well, how would you respond to a district court judge who comes from a county attorney's office and has never done any domestic work either, or a civil litigation attorney who now has to handle criminal counters, all the same challenges?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And we have an excellent educational program. One of the differences, I think, though, and I'd like to hear from Gloria on this, is a lot of district court judges will say, child welfare does not make me comfortable. You know, it's really difficult for me to hear those cases. I'm glad that you were doing it because that's something that you have a specialization in and you want to do those cases. So that's one area I would worry about, is if we're now saying to judges, you're going to have to do the divorce cases as well as the child welfare and the delinquency. And that's a problem with rotation. That's why we have such an excellent system in Utah. So you apply to be a juvenile court judge, and you're there because you want to do those cases. When you have to rotate, inevitably you have some jurors that are not comfortable or experienced in an area, and you know, just may not give it the attention that a juvenile court judge would.
And I agree, you're 100% right. There are some judges who are not comfortable with hearing certain kinds of family cases. And in a unified family court, they would not be family court judges. They're just not disposed, and nor should they be expected to be. In terms of one judge being expected to handle, you know, the gamut of cases and being expected to acquire the expertise necessary for addressing those cases, the answer depends on whether it's a one judge, one family, or one team, one family, or one case, one judge approach. But what I would want to emphasize in all of those cases is that the triage effect that I talked about, that many of the cases that go into a unified family court or family division are addressed very early on by that team of service providers and mediators, so that a number of cases don't even get to the judge, but if and when they get to the judge can really devote herself or himself to addressing the legal issues before him or her.
I have another question, and there's two questions that they are somewhat related. They asked if we were to consider implementing some sort of a unified family system that we've been talked about in the past. The two questions are as I understand some of the models, you front load services for these families. Two questions at that kind of a level is, who pays for the services, and how do you protect due process? Because I find that I see even in juvenile court, occasionally in a delinquency case, and my partner does juvenile delinquency defense cases, and first thing you do as a juvenile, you're going to meet with the probation officer. Well, wait a minute, nobody's even decided if the kid did whatever it was he was told, charged with. And so if you come in on a divorce, for example, or a protective order, and you start meeting with service people when it still hasn't really even been determined so how do you balance the due process with the services, and then who pays for the services? Because typically in juvenile court, if you're in the jurisdiction of juvenile court, the state's paying for the services. When you're in district court, and you pay. So how do you balance those two? And maybe from the other side, I'd like to hear what are some of the options that you look at when you're declaring money.
Well, in terms of who pays for it, It depends, you know, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. In Maryland, for example, the state pays for all of the services available in a court. Some grants pay for others. But the bottom line is that the services are being provided. And so it's really not a question of expanding services. And a lot of people are afraid or are concerned that a unified family court model is going to cost more. The unified family court model is still doing what all the courts are doing. It's still providing or referring individuals to services that are currently available to them. The other thing I want to say is that, and by no means unique to unified family courts, but it is a huge emphasis in a unified family court, and that is volunteer services. That, you know, as I mentioned, in New Jersey, there are citizen review boards that work in a community justice setting to work with families and children who are involved in family courts to provide pro bono services to them.
So do the state pay for private mediations as well?
In Maryland, it's need-based. So.
Okay. And what about the due process issue? When you come in for divorce, you haven't even presented any evidence on custody and some of the factors that are concerning or immediately coming to mediation. Does that create a problem?
It can create a problem. There are safeguards in place to protect due process, to protect privacy rights. It is a big issue in unified family courts. I don't want to minimize the importance of due process. There are, in the computer systems, for example, there are certain key codes that people enter into when they're reviewing a case that would preclude, for example, a mediator from seeing information about a particular family.
When you say there's no increased services, I'm having a hard time wrapping my arms around that. If somebody comes in for a divorce and the court determines that a child needs psychological counseling or some type of special schooling, that probably would not have come to the attention of any court. And if it did at the district court level, it certainly wouldn't be the state that would be paying for those services. It would be private. So I would think that the increase in services would cost a lot of money. I mean, that would just be my take on it.
Right, I'm trying to understand it too, and it seems to me that there would certainly be a cost to it.
Have there been any studies on costs to the courts before and after the uniform family court system?
There have been very few evaluations in terms of the cost-benefit analysis of unified family courts. I know that Barbara Babb's response to that is why. But those studies are few and far between about any court. So why apply the unified family court? You know, I guess my question is, if these services are already, is it that you're saying that the services are not being provided at the moment, and therefore...
Not at the divorce level.
No, not by the state. I have a question. Because in juvenile court, almost all the services are provided by the state of health and family within the district court. Now, you have the same issue with public defenders. And at what point is a public defender appointed to accept the parental rights? I'm not really sure where that comes
from. So, mediation is not
private? Not in juvenile court.
No, but I meant in divorce.
Yeah.
So, how do we go toward it?
There's a slight scale. There are some volunteer mediators as well, but it does become an issue for some cases. Okay, any other questions, Christine?
I'm going to stand up because this is all new to me. I've only been working with juvenile, the court system in my area, and UCFS and VA, and I'm not an attorney, so I know our family, a UCFS person, other than an educator, so a lot of the acronyms and the words are very different to me, but I have a lot of complaints from constituents that are going and watching this kind of family court idea. And I even spoke with some attorneys, and as I've been in court and just watched, I have concerns. And part of our problem is that we're such a small area, we don't have a lot of attorneys, so it's not our judges.
We're not likely on that.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of options that way, but people go in front of the judge, we have two juvenile judges, and they do everything in front of the judge, and by the time they get about partway through, the judge literally probably takes them, and it's very obvious in how they treat them. And I don't know if that's normal every place else. I mean, I'm very serious about that. Because they just rip these people apart, and I mean, I just go shoot myself, you know? I don't know that I would think that anything good was coming from this. I've watched in a child custody where an ex-boyfriend, and the new wife get to have the same attorney to go against someone else. I mean, the ex-girlfriend, the ex-wife, and what happens in those cases. I've witnessed what DCFS did and Guardian Ad Litem. And I registered my claims and complaints, and there are changes being made in my area. But I've spoken with especially one attorney that I consider very, very competent and highly reliable that felt like that the idea that everything goes in front of a judge is actually detrimental to these people. And you can say that they give attorney help, you know, all this, but I'm going to tell you, I really have me defending myself than the attorneys I've seen, because they're being paid by the county. They're getting like $1,000 a month to represent everyone. Not each case, represent everyone. So that equals far less than what an attorney is supposed to be normally paid. And they, that's what they do. I've watched them. I've seen what they've done. People don't understand what's happening to them because the attorneys won't take the time to talk with them. I obviously have not been anyplace else in the state but my area, but I, just as a normal person, thought, holy cow, this was stacked against them, absolutely stacked against them. They have no voice, and they don't have, and I'm sorry, if we don't care, if we don't give our schools enough, we don't give enough for services, for in-home services. They're yanking kids out of homes, they don't even give them any options. I mean, I'm not talking serious things. I understand that part. I'm not talking about those kinds. But where you could go in and help people and help these young people, a lot of them are kind of clueless. They really are. I'm sorry, they just are. That's the nature of our society, I guess. But so I'm looking forward as I listen to you about, you know, oh, we're an example to the nation. Really. I'd have to go watch some other course because I'm not sure that I believe that.
I would love it if you would come watch some of our courts in Salt Lake. You're welcome to come anytime at all.
Are you in the
Massachusetts courthouse right now?
I'd love to see that compared to what I see.
You can call Ray, and we have 6 judges at the Massachusetts courthouse. And actually, at Massachusetts, you could watch the juvenile court and the district court. So you could get a sampling of both, and you could probably find some custody cases that are pending and some child welfare cases.
Your question actually raises several different issues, and I appreciate that. I think how people do their job, you're always going to have personalities and people that don't always do what they're supposed to be doing. I will tell you that as I travel across the country, especially the Utah system of selecting judges and the way that we do things is far superior to many states that we have. Not meaning there aren't mistakes being made, but some of the points that she brings up that I think would be helpful for you both or all of you to address as far as in the unified system or in the system we have now is first of all conflict with attorneys. You know, we have public, state appointed public defenders that are representing generally those, they should be conflicted out, but sometimes they're probably not. And then I also have the question when Judge Harney was speaking about if you do have the same judge for all of those cases, at some point does that not become a detriment, especially if you're talking to process and criminal cases, which aren't criminal or juveniles technically, but you know, if you've been dealing with a family that's got all kinds of issues for 5 years and finally one of the kids shows up in your delinquency court, you know, how do you look at that with a blind eye of justice, not saying, well, one of the kids and that's where it came from? And so how do you handle those things both in the unified system or in the system that we have now?
That's an excellent question. I mean, that no doubt is an excellent question. And we hope that we take an oath, which means that we're supposed to be neutral and fair in every single case. And if you can't be neutral, and I have had colleagues do this, say, I just have too much history with this family, I'm going to recuse myself. You know, interestingly enough, it can cut the other way too, because I'll have some kids that come in and I will think, this kid has had such a horrible background. And I find myself almost bending over backwards to try and find as many ways as positive to help him because I'm so knowledgeable about his background. But I'd like to hear what Gloria has.
An excellent point, and you will find that situation, I'm sure, in every state in the country. And again, that's why one of the major reasons why many people, many advocates of unified family courts will say that the one judge, one family approach is not good. That in fact in Baltimore, they implemented a one judge, one family approach in the juvenile court, and the public defender has mounted a campaign against that because he says that it predisposes the judge not necessarily to a positive approach or positive view of the family. That's why we're leaning more and more, and you'll find advocates leaning more and more towards the one case, one judge approach, or even better, the one team, one family approach. Because that team really, I think, comprises social workers and other experts in psychology and economics and so on, really can address those family needs and give the judge information that is relevant and important to his or her decision-making process.
I wonder how you can achieve unified family court functionally without the full structural unification. Communication, coordination appear to be really huge parts of that. And what has been recommended, what has been undertaken, both in Utah and around the nation, to achieve the benefit of a unified approach to the child of the context of the problems that arise for a child or domestic violence or divorce don't drop between the cracks, but you don't get this conflict where one court says there's a restraining order and another court says there's visitation. So what are means short of structural unification that can achieve the goals of unification?
And I'd also like to add to that and have Greg explain a little bit more about my understanding of the rule that was passed is, okay, now the judges can speak to each other, but my question is, do they? Because my experience as a practitioner is just they don't, and there's no real mechanism for them, and in fact, there's still some concerns that they probably shouldn't be. So when I get a protective order in juvenile court, the divorce pending in district court, and how do I, other than just filing district court order, and I have been involved in cases where juvenile court and district court disagree on issues, and simply even to a jurisdictional fight, which sometimes can turn into an ego fight, and so how is it that we are supposedly communicating now, and probably still looking at ways to foster that communication in the future, and how it works in other places?
Well, you're right. You know, the devil is in the detail about you can create a rule where a district court and a juvenile court judge can communicate. That doesn't mean to say that they aren't. And even when they are, what about if they disagree? What about the juvenile court judge that says, I don't think your order is in the best interest of these kids, and I want to do something else? So, you know, there is room for disagreement. What are the alternatives to that? I say, first of all, better training amongst the court levels and the court levels together. We do a lot of training with separate court levels, but we rarely, at our judicial conference, both court levels are together, but the topics seem to be miles apart in terms of people's interest, if you will. So, I mean, it's like any other system that you build. If you build a system where people can communicate and they don't, I'm not sure what you do about that other than to say you're not communicating about this. Obviously, and it's interesting because you do this kind of work, you know that the judges rely on you to tell them about these conflictual orders.
problems as far as understanding the term, then.
Exactly. Yeah. So it presents problems for you as a practitioner. Lots of problems with this.
Yeah, I agree. In terms of your question, Professor Ward, how can a jurisdiction go about doing this without full unification? You know, I've emphasized some of the, you know, values behind Unified Family Court, but for every jurisdiction that is implemented at UFC, there's a different model. There are many different models, many different ways of implementing a Unified Family Court approach. Some jurisdictions have done it by legislation. Other jurisdictions have done it by court rules. In Maryland, we had a chief judge who came and who really liked Unified Family Courts, and he just said, this is what we're going to do. In other jurisdictions, for example, Atlanta, they have a pilot Unified Family Court approach that whereby the trigger is a particular case. For example, domestic violence. All domestic violence cases then go into a Unified Family Court approach, and those judges hearing the domestic violence case would hear all of the other related cases in that and for that individual. So those are just some of the ways that it can be.
Thank you very much. My last question, kind of trying to wrap up here, is actually from Professor Ward. Where do you see our courts and the demographics that lead to the people coming to our courts in the next 20 years or so? What are some of those major challenges, particularly the family law issues, and how do you see addressing those challenges? What will be the problems in addressing those problems? And I just like to have you give us a comment on that. Wrap up. Nobody wants to start down.
Oh, I find it. We're directing it at Professor
Moore. No, this is a question, and I think it's a good one. Go ahead.
Wow. Well, what I hope to see in the next few years is more communication, more education, more training, more coordination with the district court. And I don't necessarily think specialization is a bad thing. I think that that can be very helpful in many areas. So I do think that we're going to have a great influx of delinquency issues and an increase in delinquency caseloads as our young children get older, and also an increase in child welfare issues. And I think that that the issues will grow more complicated, which is why it's really important for us to have the education and training.
Thank you.
I'm going to leave it at that for the 20-year view, but I want to talk about the 3-year view. we talk about services is the key to addressing individual problems of families. We're not talking about, I assume all of you know that we're not talking about increasing services for kids that are in the custody of DCFS or Juvenile Justice Services or Juvenile Court right now. We are talking about reducing those services. And in some cases, matter of fact, I was in a hearing this morning where one of the proposals is to not require DCFS to investigate a case where there's been domestic violence and it's affected the children, that they don't have to investigate that anymore. So I think over the short term, I am very concerned about the implications of the economy on the services for kids. And this goes to literally every level within the juvenile court. The delinquent kid who's got a problem with drugs, we cannot get kids into treatment right now. It takes a long time, and when they do get into treatment, the treatment, just to be completely honest, is not very good. The same with mental health and getting help for kids and families that have mental health issues. The waiting list is very long, and so that there's this long-term view of the big picture about communication, structural issues, all of that. But what about the short term? And where are we headed in the short term? And what I can tell you is that I spend a fair amount of time up at the legislature here lately. I am very concerned about the services that families and kids can get to resolve their problems. And in my mind, that is a big part of the equation and solution.
I agree completely, and I think it's unfortunately not just short term, but I think the implications of the economy are going to go on for a long time beyond the 3-year period. I think, you know, this conversation has highlighted a number of forces that are at odds with each other: fragmentation, specialization, the economy, and it's the burden of the courts and the justice system to reconcile those and to promote unification, ironically, in the face of all of these different forces that are pulling families apart.
Well, that's a very good time to conclude on it. We have, usually in the case of climate cancers, are about needs versus resources, specialization versus integration, and I would say how involved states get in substituting itself for the family and other families to integrate. It's very interesting to think about it. I'd like to thank our presenters very much, and thank all of you for being here.
Yeah. Oh, I got it.